I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Obama's plan to send an additional 30,000 troops to Afghanistan is getting its first hearing on Capitol Hill today. The Senate Armed Services Committee is hearing from Defense Secretary Robert Gates and other officials, among them Senator John McCain, who praised the plan but also said it was a mistake for the president to include an 18-month timeline for the start of a U.S. departure.
A date for withdrawal sends exactly the wrong message to both our friends and our enemies in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and the entire region.
We're going to spend the next half hour talking about Afghanistan with several guests. First, we turn to Eric Malmstrom. He served as an Army captain in the 10th Mountain Division in Afghanistan in 2006 and 2007. He's now a graduate student at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and he joins us in the studio. And Eric, you were on the ground fighting in Afghanistan. What is your view of the president's plan?
Well, I think certainly his decision to increase the troop levels is going to be welcome to the troops on the ground. Most units in Afghanistan have been overstretched, and I think in the short term, it's certainly going to help them do their jobs and get a better handle on the security situation. Regarding the rest of the speech, I think there's not a lot new, in my opinion, in the speech. A lot of what President Obama said, he had already laid out in March, aside from the troop levels and then also the timeline, which Senator McCain just mentioned. And I feel the timeline I'm also a little bit critical of, because he's laid out some very ambitious goals that I think are unrealistic to think that we'll achieve those within 18 months. And I think he's kind of boxed himself into a corner there.
So you think it would take much longer and more troops?
Certainly. I think the troops, I mean, we could always use more troops, but I don't think they're the central problem. I think the central problem is that the Karzai government and the Afghan state are perceived to be illegitimate by the Afghan people and corrupt and generally failed. And I think that ultimately a sustainable solution is going to involve putting the responsibility on that government and not on the U.S. military. And I think in the short term, the troops will certainly help get a better handle on the security situation. But if that's not paired off with a serious focus on developing Afghan capacity, both in terms of security forces and also in terms of political economic advances, and I think that ultimately this isn't going to bring about the changes that President Obama seeks to achieve.
Now, I read about when you were in Afghanistan, you actually lived in small encampments in very remote areas of the country. It seemed to be very effective in terms of improving security in those areas. You built relationships with villagers, but it was very dangerous. Do you think that the president's plan, how does it fit in with what you were doing when you were in Afghanistan?
Sure. In addition to the increase in troop levels, General McChrystal has moved away from the model of counterinsurgency that my unit was operating off of in 2006, 2007, and has started shutting down a lot of the remote mountain outposts that I served in, and is instead focusing on the main population centers. I have mixed feelings. I feel like ultimately us fighting in the remote valleys is very manpower intensive, very difficult, and we're inherently going to have issues trying to achieve our objectives out there. And I think that there's a higher payoff in the population centers, but people tend to forget that we moved out to the remote valleys because before we were focusing too much on the population centers. And ultimately, a lot of the fight is conducted in the remote areas along the border. And so I think the best strategy would include elements of both plans, where the conventional forces are moved more in the major population centers and special operation forces are able to fight in the remote mountain valleys.
I understand you're a member of the National Guard. You wouldn't be deployed again, but would you go back to Afghanistan if you could?
Part of the reason that I left the active duty Army was I felt like a lot of the issues that I was dealing with in the military were much broader than purely military and security issues. And my education now is designed to address some of the policy issues that we have in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and other parts of the world. I would not be opposed to going back to Afghanistan, but I'd like to go back as a civilian and not in the military.
Because
ultimately, I feel like I could make more of an impact outside of the military than I could within.
You've written very powerfully about having conflicted feelings about coming back from Afghanistan. Why is that?
I think it's common for most veterans to, when they take a step back from their experience and think about what they actually did, I think most veterans have those conflicted feelings. I think there's a lot of pride from serving and from leading men in combat, but at the same time, you kind of question, what did you ultimately achieve? And I looked at my own experience, which was marked by losing some of my own soldiers. My commander was killed. My unit took a lot of casualties. We did a lot of good, but in the end, the unit that followed me had even more difficulties, and ultimately we pulled out of the valley that I had set up outposts in. And I think when you see that and you kind of question in the long term, what did I accomplish? I think there's a lot of inherent conflicting feelings that come along with that.
Do you think the United States can win in Afghanistan?
I think it depends on what it means to win. I think ultimately what we're trying to achieve is a state that's relatively stable and that does not become a sanctuary for Al-Qaeda and Taliban, and I think we can definitely achieve that. I think the administration has been right to kind of pare back what we expect to do in Afghanistan. And instead of talking about achieving lofty things like a democratic government and establishing a free market economy, I think that is unrealistic, but I do think we can establish a relatively stable state that we can leave behind in good conscience.
Okay. Eric Malmstrom served as a captain in the U.S. Army in Afghanistan. He is now at Harvard's Kennedy School. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks very much.
We're going to turn now to another voice on the war in Afghanistan. Bing West is a retired Marine captain. He served in Vietnam. He's a former Assistant Secretary of Defense. He's also a journalist who has made several trips to Iraq and Afghanistan. He's been on our program before. And Bing, the president did not use the word victory last night, but don't Americans need to know what winning in Afghanistan would look like?
Absolutely. And I must say that everything that Eric just said, I agree with. I think Malmstrom, as a captain over there, did just a terrific job. I've been out with his outfit, and I know how hard it is for him to come back and know that we've pulled out of that particular area. That's what Eric was saying is right on the money. We are defining victory as turning the war over to the Afghans. That's the right thing to do, but it's very hard to tell the American public that's how you define victory.
But Eric also mentioned Hamid Karzai's government being such a big problem because it's so flawed.
Yes. What he didn't say is what I anticipate really is going to happen over the next 18 months. We're going to give Karzai the mushroom treatment, you know, where you put him in a cave and treat him as a mushroom, and things go on around him. It was interesting that the president said he doesn't believe any longer in nation building because it costs too much. I think that that's a real signal that we're putting our chips on the Afghan military developing. And then what that means politically, we'll just let the Afghans figure that out. In other words, just like in Pakistan, the army is the behind-the-scenes manipulator of what happens politically. We may be heading down that identical line in Afghanistan, and that may not be bad for us as long as they can dominate the Taliban.
Do you think that the United States can turn this war over to the Afghans and be victorious with 30,000 troops in 18 months?
No, absolutely not. Nowhere near close. And all this training of the Afghan security forces, I think all your listeners should understand that the way you train them is that our trainers are advisors out there on the front lines fighting with them. So we're going to see more fighting, especially now that we're sending the Marines in first. I mean, everyone better stand by, because February and March, there's going to be some major fighting, and there's no way we can do this in 18 months.
And briefly then, what do you think we would need?
Well, I think that what the president's saying is, just like Eric said, very dangerous, that he's basically saying we're going to surge up, and then we're going to pull right out. I'm afraid that's a tricky message, because he's saying more troops to get the job done, but then we're getting out because of political reasons. I think we just need more quiet about when we leave. I don't care how many, I agree with Eric, 30,000 troops, you start pulling them out within a year, I'm fine with that. Just don't talk about it a lot.
All right, Bing West, a retired Marine captain who's also a journalist who writes about the military in Iraq and Afghanistan. Bing, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, in his speech last night, President Obama spoke directly to some of his critics who said that the war in Afghanistan is another Vietnam.
Unlike Vietnam, we are not facing a broad-based popular insurgency. And most importantly, unlike Vietnam, the American people were viciously attacked from Afghanistan and remain a target for those same extremists who are plotting along its border.
Andrew Basevich is a professor of international relations at Boston University. He's also a retired Army colonel who served in Vietnam and is a longtime critic of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And Professor Basevich, your thoughts on the president's speech and sending 30,000 more U.S. troops on an 18-month timeline. What do you think of the president's statement first that Afghanistan is not another Vietnam?
Well, historical analogies are never perfect. But in this case, I think there really are some instructive analogies. President Johnson was ill-served by a set of advisors who lacked imagination, who approached Vietnam in a Cold War context, and therefore failed to help Johnson find a solution other than escalation. My sense is that President Obama is equally ill-served by General Jones, Secretary Gates, Secretary Clinton, who are themselves prisoners of a national security consensus that limited the options presented to President Obama. We have fallen into the habit of believing that security requires the United States to project global military power. President Obama could have been the president to challenge that consensus. Afghanistan gave him the perfect opportunity to make that case. And he squandered the opportunity, and I think that's a great tragedy.
But the president's contention was that this is an epicenter of violent extremism. And if something wasn't done, he said attacks are being planned against the United States as he was speaking last night. Are you saying that it's not really that much of a threat to the United States?
I think that the jihadist threat is real, but in fact is relatively limited. When the president said in his speech that Afghanistan and Pakistan constitute the epicenter of this threat, he was playing fast and loose with the facts. The reality is that jihadism is not centered in any particular place. This is a transnational problem. It is a problem that stems from resentments and animosities that are found in many places across the Islamic world. So the implication that somehow going to the source, fixing Afghanistan, will substantially alleviate or reduce those resentments and animosities, I think is completely wrong.
Andrew Basevich is a professor of international relations at Boston University. He'll be back with us in just a minute. It's Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. Andrew Basevich joins us. He's a professor of international relations at Boston University and a longtime critic of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And Professor Basevich, so if, as you argue, Afghanistan is not vital to U.S. national security interest, what should we do there? What should the strategy be for Afghanistan and Pakistan?
Well, I think the real question is what should be the U.S. strategy with regard to the jihadist threat. The strategy inaugurated by President Bush after 9/11 was a strategy of global war, with the expectation that American military power could bring about a fundamental transformation in the Islamic world. That effort has failed, and the failure of Bush's freedom agenda, as he called it, really leaves the United States in a strategic vacuum. So the question is not what do we do about Afghanistan, but what are the principles that should inform U.S. policy in the wake of the failure of President Bush's global war on terror? So from my point of view, the president and his advisors have been obsessing over the last 3 months about the wrong question. And the fact that they have obsessed about the wrong question helps to explain why this opportunity to bring about real change in U.S. policy has been squandered.
And real policy, what would that look like to you?
Let's forget about a global war against terror. Let's define the enemy for what it is. It's an international criminal conspiracy. These are a bunch of thugs. And the response to an international criminal conspiracy is an international police effort. Comprehensive, sustained, well-resourced, even ruthless. A collaborative effort with our friends and allies who share our opposition to terrorism to identify and root out and destroy the terrorist networks such as Al-Qaeda. That doesn't involve invading and occupying countries. It would, in fact, I think, give us a more effective response to the actually existing problem and also at a lower cost.
Andrew Bacevich is professor of history and international relations at Boston University. His forthcoming book is titled Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. Dr. Bacevich, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
We turn now to Rajiv Chandrasekharan. He's associate editor and Afghanistan correspondent for The Washington Post. His book on Iraq is titled Imperial Life in the Emerald City, Inside Iraq's Green Zone. And Rajiv, we just heard from Andrew Bacevich, and he said that the president's characterization of Afghanistan and Pakistan as being the epicenter for violent extremism is not entirely accurate. Now, you've been reporting from Afghanistan. Do you think that there is a disconnect between the reality of what's on the ground in Afghanistan and what you hear people describing in Washington?
Well, there is a disconnect insofar as the connection between and the activities of Al-Qaeda-linked militants in Afghanistan and the perception of that in Washington and the reality on the ground. The reality on the ground is that there are a lot of Taliban insurgents. There are precious few, if any, high-level terrorist leaders with international ambitions who are still operating in Afghanistan today. It's far safer for them to be across the border in the mountainous tribal regions of Pakistan or in many other parts of the world, Yemen, Somalia, et cetera, as we know very well. And it's an open question as to whether if the Taliban were to essentially take more overt control over larger parts of the country, whether A, they would extend an invitation back to Al-Qaeda's senior leadership to come back to Afghanistan, and B, whether they would actually avail of that invitation, whether they would once again think that Afghanistan was a suitable place from which to base some of their operations, or whether places like Pakistan and other parts of the globe are actually more hospitable these days.
So it gets very murky in terms of gauging the national security threat that might be posed. Is that what you're saying?
It is, and you know, the argument that the president makes is one that's based on several sort of key assumptions, and that is that you know, if the Taliban were to take over, they would invite these people back in, and that they would then be able to use Afghanistan as a staging ground yet again. And then the way to deal with that, of course, in the view of the administration, is to prop up the Afghan government by training its security forces, by fixing government services down to a local level so that the Afghans with the NATO forces will be able to vanquish the Taliban or at least marginalize them to such a degree that they won't be able to then potentially get in league with Al-Qaeda again. It's a multi-step logic chain here.
You know, there's a lot here. There's been a lot of discussion this half hour of the Afghan government, of Afghan President Hamid Karzai in particular. Reportedly, he's pleased with this plan from President Obama. You covered Karzai's re-election, but you write that the Obama administration has adjusted its expectations of Karzai. What do you think is going to happen here? Do we put enough pressure on the Karzai government here to be able to achieve success in Afghanistan?
Well, I think that the talk of a or not just the talk, but the but the real sort of pledge to start drawing down forces in July 2011 sends something of a mixed message to the Afghans. On one hand, I think it may well result in some Afghans who've been sitting on the fence looking at this and saying, well, why should we get out there and support the Karzai government because the Americans are just going to leave us? On the other hand, it may compel Karzai's government into taking at least some more action and moving with a degree of alacrity that they haven't yet demonstrated. But we shouldn't fool ourselves into thinking that the Karzai government can solve all these problems by itself. I think back here in Washington, there's this view that Karzai's sort of all-powerful. Just because he can hire and fire governors, he can sort of fix all of this. Well, he's actually a pretty weak leader. And part of the new approach is going to be work around Karzai, work with local governors, and try to circumvent Kabul to achieve the necessary changes in governance and to fight corruption.
Okay, Rajiv Chandrasekaran, Associate Editor and Afghanistan Correspondent for The Washington Post. Thanks for being with us.
Good to talk to you.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, did the prosperity gospel help cause the economic crash? That's tomorrow. The news is next. It's Here and Now. I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Hurricane Katrina wiped out 80 square miles of marsh in the New Orleans area. 4 years later, the wetlands are still disappearing. Since Hurricanes Katrina and Rita, Louisiana has lost more than 300 square miles of wetlands. In fact, a marine biologist says the area west of New Orleans is the fastest disappearing landmass on Earth. Wetlands are important because they can serve as buffers to coastlines against floods and erosion. They also provide habitats for wildlife and plants. And those two hurricanes might have caused less damage if some of the Louisiana wetlands hadn't already disappeared. The BBC's Matthew Wells visited the New Orleans area and prepared this report.
Welcome to the swamps in Louisiana, y'all. Look at a little alligator on your right over here on the log.
Lewis Hattie shows us around the waterways or bayous where he's lived all his life. His flat-bottomed airboat skims over the soggy surface as the huge propeller roars. Most of the channels here now are man-made. Suddenly, we're on the edge of a shallow sea.
We're looking at about 5 football fields straight out that used to be land because, you know, we hear about the stories about the Gulf of Mexico, how much land we're losing. Scientists say a football field every 6 minutes during hurricane season alone. Now we believe it.
The delicate ecosystem relies on fresh water from the Mississippi washing over the vast delta. Years of raising its banks for shipping, combined with industrial development, have allowed salt water from the sea to encroach. Captain Hattie used to be a fisherman before he became a swamp guide. The erosion of the wetlands is dismantling that way of life, too.
Without our marshlands and wetlands, we don't have anywhere for our fish, crustaceans such as crabs, shrimp, and crawfish, to go in to hide to reproduce. Without this, our fishing industry will be history, like other parts of the world already.
Mounds of fried catfish and prawns are served up at Booty's restaurant each day. It's another slow lunchtime. The road's already flooded and a storm is brewing. Louisiana has set up a coastal protection authority, but they need more cash from somewhere to claw back lost land. Its spokesman is Chris Macaluso.
Get some of it back. Make best use of the sediments that are available. We have 7 years to go to convince the rest of the country that it's worth investing in this place. And investing in the kind of large-scale restoration projects that it's going to take in order to be able to put the ecosystem back to work.
You walk around, you'll have different stations that will tell you the story about Lafitte in the wetlands, how important they are.
Down the road in the small town of Jean Lafitte, Mayor Tim Kerner is also doing his best to highlight the locals' plight. Their new museum and visitor center is almost finished, but it's a fight for survival from now on.
With the water coming in so fast, flooding this area out as bad as it has, I don't think, if nothing's done to the coastal restoration projects or levee projects, then I don't think we'll make it.
10, 15 years' time, there might be no one here?
I think it'll be longer than that. But I'll tell you this, though. We're going to be here because I'm going to fight very hard to get the protection.
'Cause I know that's the only way to lose the Mississippi River blues.
Further upriver, residents of New Orleans are also looking anxiously at the wetlands. The decades they've helped protect the city from hurricanes, sucking away their power. Katrina showed how things have changed. The man in charge of building up the city's defense is Lieutenant General Robert Van Antwerp. He's head of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. He says Louisiana might have to accept some new realities.
As we move forward, we surely should ask, whatever we're doing, the development, is it going to create the need for more structural solutions for protection? We ought to be asking that question right now, and we ought to be very reluctant to allow people to settle in floodplains and do all those things.
Mississippi River, let your waters flow.
Louisiana's already committed to spending $1.5 billion over the next 4 years to reclaim lost wetland. But with New Orleans still reeling from Katrina and the economy still in crisis, politicians in Washington are reluctant to provide more. The people here wait nervously as the water continues to rise.
That report from the BBC's Matthew Wells. We'll be back after a break. It's Here and Now. Welcome back. The new movie, The Men Who Stare at Goats, is about a top-secret department of the U.S. military that uses psychic powers to fight enemies. Turns out the movie might not be pure science fiction. In the 1970s, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA, was experimenting with the possibility of psychic spying. DARPA is credited with giving the Internet its start 40 years ago, and to mark that anniversary, the agency has launched the DARPA Network Challenge. It's a high-tech scavenger hunt that will award $40,000 to the first team that finds 10 red weather balloons hovering in the air around the United States. DARPA expects that people will use social networking sites like Twitter and Facebook to find these balloons. Erica Briscoe is a research engineer at Georgia Tech Research Institute. She and her group, I Spy a Red Balloon, are planning to win the DARPA contest. And Erica, can you tell us why you're taking part?
My coworker and I, Ethan Truitt, started talking about the contest once we heard about it. And we just decided that it wasn't too much effort to actually try to win it. So we put into action our ideas and decided to go for it.
Well, we'll talk about your strategy, and we won't ask you to give too much away, but first, tell us a little bit about the contest. It starts Saturday. Can you explain the contest and the rules?
Sure. On Saturday, December 5th, DARPA will release 10 red weather balloons. They will be tethered, and they will be located somewhere within the continental United States. They will go up at 10 o'clock Eastern time, and they'll stay up until 4 o'clock. And the first person who correctly identifies the location of those 10 balloons wins the $40,000.
So they could be anywhere?
As far as we know, they could be anywhere. The only restriction they have said was that they will be pedestrian accessible and visible from the roadways as well.
Visible from the roadways. So how do you think that, you said you didn't think that it would require too much effort. How do you think you're going to find all of these? And that's a short amount of time.
Well, we plan on having what we're calling a war room on Saturday, where we have a bunch of people come in and with their laptops and monitoring the reports. So we've utilized Facebook, Twitter, our website, email, and text, and then gotten our friends and our family and coworkers to spread the word and just told them on Saturday, if you see a red balloon, let us know any way you can. And then if we're not getting in a lot of reports through our own avenues, we'll also be monitoring Twitter in general, open chat rooms or blogs that people might be reporting on. So we'll try to be keeping an ear out all over the network.
Now, it's my understanding that the intent of this contest, for DARPA anyway, is to figure out how social networking tools like Facebook and Twitter might be used in innovative ways to do sort of group communication like this, or crowdsourcing, I believe is what folks refer to it as. Do you think that your strategy uses any sort of unique way in terms of social networking sites that might be helpful here in really what the objective of the contest is?
I'm not sure. I don't know how unique ours actually is compared to other teams, because not many people are really sharing right at this point. But competitive advantage. I think what will be unique is really how it plays out in terms of how the winning team if we find out how they actually got the location. So it may just be that on that day we have enough people out there that they report back the 10 locations and it's all done with pretty quickly. But it may be, and this is probably more likely, that some of the locations are going to be a bit more obscure. So we might have to either send people out to corroborate some of the sightings that we have. We might have to team with other teams. If we know we have 6 locations and maybe another team has 4, maybe we'll contact another team to share. In terms of how it actually plays out on the day is going to be where it really gets interesting.
What about the possibility, that's probably very real, that people would report false locations to throw their competitors off the track?
Right. That's something we definitely have to be aware of and ready for. Some things we know, like if, for instance, we get one sighting in New York City, but only one from one person, there's probably a chance that's a false one because we have a lot of people in New York, so we know we should get multiple ones. So in something like that, we could send out someone to make sure there actually is a balloon there. Otherwise, we're really going to have to do kind of on-the-fly data analysis and make sure that what we're looking at or what we're getting in, you know, seems right. And if we're getting in 30 locations instead of the 10, then, you know, we know that 20 are probably false, and we have to kind of figure out which ones those are.
Now, you say thousands of people. You have thousands of people all over the country throughout these social networking sites who are looking for these red balloons for you. Is that right?
Yep, you can sign up on our website just to let us know where you're at, and we have a couple hundred people on the Facebook. In terms of people we've notified, yeah, it's definitely in the thousands.
Okay, well, we will link to your website on our website, but I'm wondering, is that really your main strategy here? I hate to say it like this, but is it really your only strategy that you're just relying on these folks, these people who have at least at one point looked at your site online and relying on them to report locations?
Well, yeah, basically. I mean, I guess that's the gist of it all, is getting enough people out there. Also, well, part of our strategy is that we are going to give the money to charity. So there are a lot of teams out there who are splitting up the prize money to give to the people who report. So we hope that giving to charity will be enough incentive for people to be on the lookout and report back to us, and also doing a good thing.
What do you think DARPA and maybe all of us will learn from this contest?
I think there's several things that are going to be interesting. The obvious one is the speed of what happened. So depending on where the balloons are placed, if they were all within urban areas, I think we all would anticipate that it would be over pretty quickly. But if there are some out in rural, more remote areas, it'll be interesting to see how fast those areas have been accessed and how quickly the information spreads back. Another interesting thing will be how that information spreads to the team. So if there is one in a rural area, will that information only spread to one team, or will it actually get disseminated among all the teams? The interesting part, I think, will be is how the information spreads throughout the various social networks.
Do you run the risk, though, of, especially in a competitive situation like this, do you run the risk of, you know, you're looking at other people's websites and Twitter accounts and seeing where their locations are, or they're looking at yours, and really everybody's got sort of an awful lot of information to sift through and determine whether it's accurate?
Right, yeah. I mean, that's definitely a problem. So that's where it does help to have, you know, people that day helping you to do that. And also having a couple of strategies in place in case the information gets overwhelming. Luckily, that's kind of some of the work that we do at our job. So that's where we have a little bit of advantage, my teammates and I.
Well, Erica, good luck.
Thank you so much.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Welcome back. What are we, as Americans, collectively Googling? Well, Google released its annual report about online search trends in 2009. It's called Google Zeitgeist. The idea is that by looking at an aggregate of what Americans are Googling, you can get a sense of what people are thinking about. John Abel has been looking at the trends. He's New York City Bureau Chief for Wired.com. And John, can you tell us which words and phrases had the fastest growing number of searches?
Well, some obvious ones, Twitter, which has had a remarkable year of expansion. Michael Jackson, whose untimely death actually almost crippled Google for about 3 hours. But there's some surprise entrants there, like Glee, the very popular Fox TV show, and Paranormal Activity, the movie that cost about 27 cents to make and was released only a couple of months ago. So to have those crop up in a top 10 of Google is really quite remarkable.
What about the big news stories of the year that people wanted to learn more about?
The top search term in the news category was crisis, On the list also was Kennedy and swine flu.
Now, what about the searches that were falling the fastest?
The number one fastest falling was McCain, the failed 2008 presidential candidate, and that sort of makes sense.
Also, Google looks at how-to searches. Can you tell us what were people trying to learn how to do?
The number one is how to kiss, which is either very sad or means that there are a lot of underage children using Google and not kissing their hands anymore the way people of a certain age learn how to do it.
But what do we do when, or what do you think people do? What do they make of this information?
Well, I don't know what we make of it. It sort of makes for fun cocktail conversation. But I think that people are turning to search engines to find out things which a couple of generations ago we would turn to the radio or the TV. To some extent now, the thunder is being stolen by Twitter, because very often people will go there first.
And Twitter, of course, was the fastest rising search query on Google.
Well, there you go.
John Abel, New York City Bureau Chief for Wired.com. He's been looking at Google's search trends for 2009. John, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
If you had to choose between the invention of Cracker Jacks or the first cookbook ever written, between the construction of the Erie Canal or the 1848 revolution in Germany, what would you say was a major turning point for food in the United States? Andrew Smith has some surprising answers. He's the author of the new book, Eating History, 30 Turning Points in the Making of American Cuisine. And Andrew, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for inviting me, Deb.
You know, a story in your book that stuck out to me was maybe the story of the first declared vegetarian in 1830, Sylvester Graham.
He's the one who popularized vegetarianism in the 1830s. That's absolutely true.
Yeah. Yeah. And he was advocating diet to fight disease.
He was advocating diet as a means to fight disease, and in addition to that, he thought that everyone was really eating too much, they were eating the wrong things. So his real goal was to change American diet, and in many ways he succeeded. And John Harvey Kellogg, who creates cereal and peanut butter and thousands of other vegetarian products, really gets his beginning by reading all of Graham's works.
That was one point in the history of food, but your book mentions several. Some of them you call turning points, like the first cookbook by Fannie Farmer and things like that. But I also wonder, why was the invention of the Cracker Jack so significant?
Well, the Cracker Jack is invented in Chicago in 1893. It's named in 1896, and within 2 months of the trademark of the name, the Cracker Jack Company begins to promote its products nationally. And it is the first national snack food in America, and it creates an industry that's billions of dollars today.
Another interesting turning point that you point out in the book, the Erie Canal.
With the construction of the Erie Canal, Americans gave up local eating, and they did it very easily and without any trouble whatsoever. And in fact, they really wanted the cheap grain that was coming in at that point from Western New York. Prior to that time, you would have consumed food that would have been grown or raised within a short distance of your home. Hmm. And after that time, you ate food that was you purchased food that was less costly. Americans became regional in their food consumption, and with the construction of the Transcontinental Railroad in 1869, you begin a national distribution system.
Let's go to like 1848. That's when you mentioned that immigrants really were a big influence in the American food scene.
In 1848, three different things happen in three different parts of the world. China, you have a massive revolution and drought, and a large number of Chinese decide to go to California when gold is discovered. And so you really have the beginning of Chinese-American food with these immigrants that come in. Simultaneously with that, you had a major revolution in Germany, and you had Germans migrating in mass numbers to the United States. And it's these Germans that will create the lager beer that we know and love today. And in many ways, we can attribute the hot dog and the hamburger and so many other foods that we find that we think of as American foods today. And likewise, in the same year, America signs a treaty with Mexico and acquires possession of the American Southwest, and you have the beginning of Mexican food in the United States. And I thought that was a great story that starts off thousands of miles apart and really ends up with the types of foods that we consume today.
What about the food that probably the U.S. is best known for, fast food? McDonald's, and that's everywhere now. That's our export, really, to a lot of countries. Let's talk about that a little bit.
I remember the first time I went to McDonald's, 1956. It was an incredible experience. There was nothing like it at the time. I mean, it was clean. Everyone had white uniforms on. It was glass. You put your order in. They had a little clock. They pushed that clock within 60 seconds. You got your food at the other side to it. There was no inside dining. You had to dine in your car.
Even whispering.
And, well, it was a wonderful experience that many of us remember, and that it has become a global giant has changed food waste throughout the world is part of the story. And it's how something local in San Bernardino, California, with a couple brothers that really decided they wanted to do exactly what Henry Ford did for the car industry. They wanted to make an efficient assembly line to make hamburgers and other fast foods. And they created an industry that virtually every other fast food entrepreneur of the time came to visit them. They saw what they were doing and then duplicated, not necessarily with hamburgers, but with chicken and with pizza and with thousands of other things.
Right. Would you say that the overall message in your book, aside from bringing up some of these turning points in the food industry, is that really it's a major multi-billion dollar consolidated system, really, that's our food system?
Yeah, my point was 200 years ago, we were all eating local food. We were all eating organic food. We were all eating the foods that our mothers would have prepared for us at home in the meals there. And in 200 years, we made some shifts and changes. And last year is the first year in American history where 51% of the meals were prepared outside the home.
Oh, really?
And so the point is that there are lots of reasons on why the food system is the way it is today. And for those that like convenience and like relatively low-cost food, it's a very good system. And for those that really think that the American food system has gone off track, you're going to have to be aware of these reasons on why the changes were made in the first place if you want to make changes in the system.
All right. Andrew Smith, author of Eating History, 30 Turning Points in the Making of American Cuisine. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Deb.